Welcome to the pod, Cookie.
Welcome to the pod, Scott.
Welcome to the pod, Neil.
Welcome to March 31st, 2019, and welcome to Fancy Ramen. I'm Neil.
I'm recording now.
And I'm Scott.
And this is a podcast about video games, amongst many other topics. Speaking of topics, I'm sure we will probably have quite a bit of video game talk to go over. And even though it sounds like we might not be getting super in-depth into Sekiro, maybe it'd be pertinent for us to like skip through our weeks with the exception of certain forms of media. Are you guys cool with that?
Absolutely.
Sure.
What certain forms of media?
Yeah, go ahead and give us the actual like guardrails.
Well,
here.
So I mean, I see here on our list of topics that Cookie did not have a week, as always. but more notably, Scott, you had the movie Us.
Yes, I did go and see Jordan Peele's sophomore flick, Us, last weekend. Have either of you guys seen this movie? I assume both of you have seen Get Out.
I haven't seen Get Out yet.
Neither of you have seen Get Out?
Well, Cookie saw the movie title, and he was like, oh, I guess I can't be here.
Pretty much.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if there's that much to say then. Like, there's a lot to dig into if there's at least one other person to talk to it about. Otherwise, I think maybe it's best that I keep it cursory and say that Get Out was a phenomenal film. I enjoyed watching it a lot. It was very overt in the themes and messaging that Jordan Peele was trying to communicate to the audience. Very easily recognizable that racism was the monster. But in Us, he's a lot more... He executes his storytelling and like the themes and the messages with a lot more finesse. And so after seeing this movie, I wasn't completely convinced leaving the movie theater that it was a better film than his first one, Get Out. But after ruminating on it, and really like thinking more critically about all of the symbolism and artistry that's going on kind of behind the direct execution of the plot, I'd have to say it's a very good film, and it's maybe even worth a second viewing. I might go see it again in theaters just to try and wrap up my thoughts on it. But I'm surprised that neither of you guys have seen his stuff. I really enjoyed Get Out. Get Out was the perfect fusion of like 75% to 80% horror and 20% like just comedy and entertainment.
Sweet. Did you say the word horror? Was there suspense involved as well?
It's really more suspense and thrill than it is actual horror, I guess. But it is horrifying in some ways, but suspenseful or thriller are probably better applications. And I'd say that also works in Us as well. Us just doesn't really have much of a comedic element to it besides the useless ass dad character that is played in the movie. There's no easing or like coasting on the thrill that's already or tension that's already occurred in the plot, so it's a very tense ride the whole way through.
Could I jump in for a second about Get Out real quick?
Yeah.
Am I wrong in thinking that Get Out was in some advertisements also not represented to be a horror movie and instead like looked to be almost advertised as a different genre, which is what made the movie more jarring if you went to it under that false impression?
I mean, remember seeing any advertisement that told us this was not going to be a suspense thriller for Us or Get Out.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to ask the question then, because I was under the impression that Get Out is literally about a black man essentially entering a very racist society, if you will, being introduced to the parents, though, is kind of the pretext to the movie, right?
I mean, that's sort of that to a degree is the movie. Like the thriller element that it really plays upon is the like black character, the black lead is in, I can't remember if he's in necessarily a, like, I guess it doesn't matter if it's Southern or not. It sort of looks like a very, very nice, affluent, almost plantation-style home, so maybe so. But he's obviously in an environment that he does not feel comfortable in, around people who make us as the audience, who are primarily invested in the main character and like his comfort and how he's reading the situations, essentially like weirding him out, microaggressing against him, as well as just like straight up being like overtly uncomfortable. I would have voted for Obama three times, or for a third time, kind of like it's man, I don't know how to distill it very easily. Watching the film, I think, allows you to really kind of embody the protagonist position of like detecting or reading coded language and being like essentially gaslit by the people around him into thinking that he's being paranoid or crazy. So, and go ahead.
I mean, I want to see Get Out at some point in time. I just, it's hard for me to go out and see new movies, but now that this is like on demand, I'm sure.
Yeah,
likely.
I was gonna say, but it is like 2 years old now, I think.
Does it become like, yes. So I associate horror movies with monster or killer aspects to it. Does this have that traditional sense, or is it actually more of like a
suspense
thriller?
It is suspenseful,
mindfuck.
But there is a life-threatening there's life-threatening consequences looming over the character that, like I said, the pretty much the like main composition of the movie is trying to determine if there actually is one or not. So I am spoiling it to some degree. And the main character being gaslit into thinking, oh, I'm crazy for feeling threatened or worried about this. And the culmination of the film is him realizing, oh shit, I should have like checked my gut instincts. And I should have listened to my comedic relief friend who told me to not go there at all, like not get into this situation. It's a good film. It is. It's very straightforward, though. I mean, you can kind of follow what Jordan Peele's trying to do, both with the movie itself and the overarching themes that it ties to in our, you know, daily lives. And I just think that a lot of people who enjoyed that and how kind of concrete and cut and dry it is to interpret, that seeing us is a little trickier, because this movie has like a ton of symbolism that is not, it's easy once you know it's there, but it's actually not something that I picked up on immediately. And it was only after the kind of final big reveal of the movie and the movie was over that I tied some of the elements together that I, if I were maybe a film critic, would have noticed a lot faster or taken more, given more attention to. And because of that, I want to see the film again and kind of further solidify my interpretation. But I think that Us is at its core a movie that tackles two primary topics about privilege in the sense of like haves and have nots, and with Get Out being a film that really addressed racism and especially like black and white race relations in, I think, a nuanced way. Us tackles it on a more like economic sense. It is interesting to watch the film, because I think I was telling Sierra, I only noticed the characters' races in that movie were either the like titular black family, who are our main protagonists. Otherwise, they are surrounded by what I was able to see is just a bunch of white people. Like they were in a beach town. There's one black family kind of surrounded in a sea of white people in the same way that Get Out had our like one black character who is surrounded by us. That's such an unfortunate
Freudian slip.
Not a Freudian slip. I don't think there's any association to that. But in the same way that our main character in Get Out is the one black character surrounded by a bunch of creepy white people, that's about the only actual that's about the only way that those two movies are similar in the like inequality that they're trying to tackle or grapple with. And in Us, I found that even though there's not, I guess, a racially diverse secondary cast, not the primary actors, the family that has Lupita Nyong'o and I don't know the other actors' names off the top of my head, but instead tackles the fact that they are affluent people, and that the main antagonists of the film are people who are underprivileged, underserved, are essentially like forgotten and ignored, and so they are the antithesis of these affluent people, and their race has much less to do with it than their like economic and social status that they share with their friends that they have in the film, as well as just the other people that are occupying the community around them. And so it tackles that economic disparity by further tackling an argument of nature versus nurture. And I don't want to spoil anything, because in order to talk about the nature versus nurture argument, there are like some elements of the film that I think are very important to see firsthand that I don't want to spoil. But I think it does a really good job of actually addressing that argument to some degree. And that's kind of why I want to see it again, so I can now know what I'm going in to watch a like critique or a dialogue of, as opposed to try and figure it out all after the fact, once I've forgotten details or other elements that happened in the movie that, you know, you just you see for a moment, and because they don't register to the immediate like threat of the antagonists in the plot or something, you just kind of forget them. They get washed out of your head.
Well, damn, like I'm
trying so hard not to spoil anything, which makes it very difficult because they're great films and they're both worth watching. And who would have thought that Jordan Peele would be making me interested in the horror or thriller genre, a genre that I had really, I wanted nothing to do with probably about 5 years ago. And since seeing Get Out, if he releases a movie in this genre, I will probably watch it, because I've been anything but disappointed.
You've done a really good job at like hyping, whether or not you meant to, I like hype is a bad word, I guess. You've done a really good job of intriguing me on both of these movies. Like I already wanted to see Get Out, but I'm like sold as fuck now.
Yeah, they're not simple films. They're actually very artistic, and so I really appreciate it. And he's also doing a lot for the movie industry that I think he's spoken about in interviews, where he is bringing a perspective to film that Hollywood does not have enough of, because how often do we actually see, I mean, name another movie that has four black actors as the primary protagonists.
Tyler Perry's latest movie.
Besides a Madea film.
Also, and not Black Panther, I'm guessing. You're going to say no to that one?
No, Black Panther totally counts, I think.
No, but those are the exceptions to the norm.
And they're the exceptions to the norm. They're also those films, besides the Madea films, which I'm not going
any,
to... I'm not
any
going to critique.
Ice Cube film?
Ice Cube?
Are We There Yet?
Or Are We There Yet 2? Or Are We There Yet Electric Boogaloo?
Friday. Isn't there one that Ice Cube's like camping?
I mean, that would be a great documentary movie, I think.
I think you're right, but if we're talking about straight box office numbers, have any of those movies been... But once again, Black Panther, I think, can address this, but have any of those others been like the number one movie for, I think, 2 weeks in a row or something?
And more notably, too, like the movies we're listing off are literally a drop in a pond of like white casts.
Yeah.
Which is understandable. We're just now getting over the fact that we had a black president and we thought we could do everything. And then we found out, no, we couldn't. So now we actually have to do things.
Now we have a JoJo villain as our president.
Yeah. Not even a good one.
Have you read Steel Ball Run, Scott?
I haven't, not yet.
Okay. When you get there, then you'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
But to get back to your Get Out analysis, nope, Us analysis, it has the tags of suspense, maybe thriller, on horror, I will pass. Because the world is big and scary enough. I don't need to pay to get frightened.
We can just think about the doomsday calendar.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about, you know, driving down the street while black.
And I think that maybe there is, like, we don't need to get into super deep topics on our gaming podcast, but this is, like, the value of even diversity in our three male voices is that at least the three of us occupy like a variety of like races and backgrounds in that case. And me being the white guy, and therefore I want to put myself out there. It's like when I watched Get Out at the time that I was at in my life, learning more about like equity and like racial justice and things of this nature, Get Out was actually a film that was a way for me as a white dude who grew up living a pretty average white dude life to get to, for an hour and a half or like 2 hours in a movie theater, kind of occupy to a very small degree or percentage, like just get a taste of the type of like threats that people who are not white that live in society that is mostly built for white people have to go through day to day. And I think that was one of the things that made me and a lot of other white audiences appreciate that movie so much, is going into it with an open mind. It made you think, oh shit, there's a lot of stuff that I don't worry about on a day to day or even like hour to hour basis that this main character has to deal with that I understand are not, like, they're not hurdles or threats that I'm ever going to encounter in a general sense.
Well, since we're on the topic of just going over what we did this week via the media edition and socioeconomic discrepancies in life, Lizzie got to see for the first time a classic movie that I really enjoyed from my past, Kung Fu Hustle.
Hell yeah.
It is now on Netflix. She's like, I was like, what do you want to do tonight? And she's like, I just want to relax. Can we watch a movie? And I was like, yes. Yes, we can. There's a movie I want you to see. She's like, what's the movie? Kung Fu Hustle. And she said, no. Or I guess, let me see a trailer.
Oh, no.
And I was like, okay. She said, It had enough humor bits in it that she was willing to give it a try. And I think I've made a Stephen Chow fan out of her. She enjoyed Kung Fu Hustle.
Kung Fu Hustle may be one of the best Kung Fu films of all time. And has CGI that still is probably better than what I'm seeing in Umbrella Academy.
No.
Today in 2019.
No, it's not.
Could I recommend that if she likes that, you need to introduce her to the movie God of Gamblers, which doesn't star Stephen Chow, and I'll get to it in a second. It has Chow Yun-fat in it instead. God of Gamblers does have a lot of ridiculous comic points or comical points to it. I won't get into details. I feel like I might have gone into details about this show before later. But more importantly, after you watch the first movie, you can then start to watch the official... Or, okay, sorry. You can then watch the parody movie, which I think is like All for the Money or something like that. Starring
All for the Winner.
All for the Winner, starring Stephen Chow. Or, yeah, Stephen Chow. Which was so successful that the company that owns God of Gamblers was like, well, we know what to do with our sequel, God of Gamblers 2, starring Stephen Chow, or one of the sequels. They literally started using Stephen Chow in God of Gamblers because it was so good.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, God of Gamblers 2 in 1990 continues where the original God of Gamblers left off. Andy Lau's character teams up with Stephen Chow's character from All for the Winner.
Nice.
Yes. But yeah, Stephen Chow has so many fucking good movies.
Yeah. The next thing I wanted to watch is going to be Shaolin Soccer. Mm.
Shaolin Soccer is fantastic.
And I think that's all that Netflix currently has right now.
God of Cooking is also great.
Hmm.
But yeah, either way. So just wanted to throw that out there. We got to watch Kung Fu Hustle. And for the listeners who haven't seen it, it's currently on Netflix. It is about a China that is overrun by a major gang called the X Gang and how they are profiting off of everything in their area except for they like to leave alone the slums. Except for one particular day, some things happen, and then they have to deal with a specific slum that happens to have many kung fu masters in it.
Named Pigsty Alley.
Yes, Pigsty Alley is the slum's name, and it has many kung fu masters in it, so there ends up being a big fight, and there is a little... the main character is a hero destined to save the world, but he just doesn't know how to or realize how to until he does. And then the movie ends with a very beautiful scene of another little child who is also destined to save the world, but instead of getting conned into spending $10 on one kung fu manual, he gets to see six kung fu manuals. Either way, it's a very charming and beautiful Stephen Chow movie.
Yeah. And have you seen Shaolin Soccer before?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
It's a classic.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of that one as well. Especially when it turns out that steroids just turn you into like an evil demonic soccer player.
Which I mean, there's a lot of things wrong in these in his movies in terms of like social issues and like, I mean, shit that we can go all PC on, but that's one message we can all get behind.
Steroids are bad. Well, yeah, because Shaolin Soccer has the woman who gets progressively more and more beautiful throughout the film, and she's just treated like shit until she's gorgeous.
That also happens in God of Cooking, too.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah, so that's the movie lineup.
So, since we talked about diversity, we actually have an email that maybe kind of
nice
talks about us.
Welcome to Fancy Ramen, the Diversity and Inclusion Podcast.
I mean, it's really not about diversity that much, but I think it was suitable.
Tonkatsu, you've got Shoryu, you've got...
Wait, dragon? You have dragon ramen? What the hell's that mean?
I don't know, man.
Okay,
I must be mispronouncing some other ramen that I thought I have had.
If you want to correct us on our ramen and Japanese pronunciations, you can write into podcast@fancyramen.com. This one comes in from Nathaniel. Stumbled on your podcast a few weeks ago. Aside from the recent episodes, I did go back and listen to your first to a surprising different set of voices. Is there a specific episode where you could lose/gain members to your current to the current roster? Also,
episode 2.
Sorry, what's that?
Episode 2.
Yeah, basically.
Episode 2 is the answer.
The rest of the email is also Cookie refers to Devolver Digital as Neil's favorite publisher. Is Neil the indie guy in the bunch? For new listeners, would you say any of you have a favorite genre or game type preference?
Neil, I think you get to go first, since you probably have the... Well, is that true, Cookie? Episode one is... It's you and Neil and...
Buck and the guys.
Buck and the guys. And yeah. Then two is just you and Neil.
And then it changes out. There's literally an episode that says 100% more Scott. And so...
Yeah, now with 100% more Scott is episode six. To new listeners, if you want to hear my introduction to the podcast, that's episode six. And I think we devolve pretty heavily into JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, because I found out that Neil was also a fan.
And that was like the next five episodes is JoJo.
It's really hard to shrug the addiction.
And there's some special episodes that have like typically end of the year episodes or start of the year episodes at the date we record and release them have. Yep. John, Buck, and Keith, who are also active on the Let's Play videos on the YouTube channel. If you have not subscribed or looked at that.
We also had the big Persona 5 talk that included you and John and Keith, as well as Caitlin in that. And was that like a huge 2-hour episode or something that we did?
As for the second part of the conversation, I don't remember Devolver Digital like this coming up.
So, I've said it before.
So I'm assuming it's probably a joke then? Or
no,
maybe
no. I think it is true to some extent. You are
You do like Devolver Digital.
Yeah, you are a fan of Devolver.
I think anytime E3 comes up and
oh, yeah,
Devolver Digital
you.
Has their shows, and that's the one conference that you're just like, fuck yeah, Devolver Digital.
Yeah, it's because I think basically every conference at E3 is a fucking joke. So when I see one that is actually a joke, and it's like, it's not like conferences are useless. It's just that in our day and age where publishers and developers literally have immediate access to their audience right at their fingertips through Twitter, social media, and other forms, YouTube. It's like, why waste your time with a conference if you don't have to? So when Devolver Digital makes a joke of it, I appreciate that.
So I don't think a lot of developers / anyone realized that they had access at their fingertips until recently, Neil.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. Or they did, but there were people in the company that are like, we have to do this. And now we're in a day and age where, like, literally PlayStation is, or Sony specifically, is not showing up to E3 and they're holding their own conference, which, surprise, Nintendo did that, what, a couple years ago? I think there was a year where, like, Microsoft was also practically absent. And it's not to say that these companies didn't have things going on those specific years. It's just that, like, they realize that they have much more control over their message when they do things under their own
house.
Yeah.
Umbrella.
But then they can't do the flute guy on the stage.
God. Sony's last E3 was such a fucking mixed bag, too. It's like, yeah. I don't blame them for being like, well, that was fucking ridiculous. Let's try something different. I don't necessarily think that I'm like that they're my favorite publisher. If anything, it'd probably be Sega, and it's not for the it's because they publish Atlus.
So you are our indie guy, though. Will you take that mantle?
I don't think I am. I think Scott plays more indie games than me. Like, you've been talking about, like, way more indie games than me in the long run. I think I'm just like the weird niche visual novel guy, which sometimes means a lot of indie games.
I think that's probably fair for new listeners. I do love indie games. Like, I actually, if I said I had a favorite genre, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with the decision I give like a week later, because one of the things that keeps me definitely digging into lots of indie titles is that they're so diverse and different. But I dig indie games. I love roguelikes, and a lot of indies do that. And so that's probably one of my favorites.
slash Metroidvanias?
Metroidvanias and roguelikes are my bread and butter. And if From Software makes a game, I'm going to play it, which we'll talk about in a bit. And then, Cookie, you also have like some niche elements. Like you tackle most of our mainstream heavy lifting because you'll actually play like Call of Duty and whatnot. But when it comes to just sheer volume of games that you buy and at least play a couple hours of, I think you do most of the work there.
Was that like a low key burn?
No, it's not a burn. No, it's not a burn.
I am your everyman gamer of the podcast.
You were also our VR expert for a good period of time. Like you are ultimately the technology expert between the three of us when it comes to general gaming tech.
No, I could see that. And I will say my favorite genre of game is fighter, but you won't hear me talking very much about fighters, unfortunately, because I don't play them as much as I would like to. I'm more focused on my shooters.
It's evident watching you play a fighter, though, that you are good at fighters.
I do like my fighters. And oh my gosh, there's a fighter I want to talk about today that I haven't had a chance to play, but they're having a beta right now.
Are we ready to transition? I'm good on all of my topics.
Yeah.
And I guess, was that a good enough answer for the question?
If not, Nathaniel can write back and say, hey, no, more details, please.
I could real quickly say, if it's not obvious, I'm probably the turn-based RPG visual novel guy. I play a lot of that specific niche. I'm the shameless anime video game guy, I think.
Is Suikoden 2 a genre? Because Neil is Suikoden 2.
I haven't been streaming that specific one for a while, but
weren't you streaming Suikoden 3 this morning?
Yeah, I've been so
okay. Sorry, Suikoden 3 is his genre.
He evolved.
Yeah,
I've evolved twice. No, I mean, we could either segue to the fighting games or Suikoden at this point, and I would say let's do fighting because I'm assuming this is a game I'm very interested in.
Is it? Ooh,
depends.
That sounds fun.
Does it involve a guy named Galford and his dog Lucky?
No.
Oh fuck. Okay.
What game are you talking about?
So I obviously can't keep up with video game news as well as of late, but I thought maybe you were going to talk about a Samurai Showdown beta or something, because that's got to come out, you know, for Evo.
It comes out exactly 2 weeks before Evo.
And Galford is I'm gonna fact check myself, but yeah, no, I my memory did serve correct. He's the blue ninja that has the dog, the husky-ish type dog that is badass.
Yes, unfortunately, no beta for a Samurai Showdown. If there was, I don't think I'm trying to figure out what's the next fighting game I'm gonna buy. It's either going to be Samurai Showdown or the game I was hinting at earlier that's having a beta right now, and that game is Mortal Kombat 11.
Of course.
And my God, that game looks great. NetherRealm Studios has just done it again.
Not Japanese enough for me. Sorry, just making the joke since I alluded to it before. No, but really, it does look super awesome. Has the beta been going on for long? Have you had like a lot of time to play it?
I haven't had any time to play it because I didn't pre-order it. And unfortunately, it was just going on for this weekend. And by the time I realized it was happening, it was like 2 o'clock yesterday, and I was like, okay, I don't need to pre-order this game right now just to be able to play it for like 3 or 4 hours this weekend. I'll just save my money and then pre-order it slash buy it later. But from what I've been watching of gameplay, the NetherRealm Studios has done it again with the sheer amount of customization that you can do to your character. They had a 1 hour live stream just going over the moves of Jax. Oh God, I think it was Jade and someone else. Liu Kang, Jax, and I forget who the third character was, but they showed off just two variants and a little bit of the customization customization that you could do to each character. One thing that they really started back in, I think, during Mortal Kombat X or Injustice. I forget which one actually came out first. But they really, like, doubled down on the, hey, you can customize your character with not only gear that changes stats, but also the physical appearance. And then Injustice 2, they started introducing items that allow you to equip and change moves. And they put this into Mortal Kombat 11. So, like, one of the crazy things that Jax has is he's got... They showed two different setups, a zoning setup slash, like, a Jax punches a lot, so a punching setup, and a grappling setup. Each time Jax lands a punch, his arms started to glow, and at full charge, that then made his attacks a lot more powerful slash gave him his the energy blasters that he was able to shoot in the old school games. And he's also got a shotgun, just a nice double barrel shotgun, because why not? Oh, Scorpion was the last character that they had, because they showed off Scorpion with his katanas, and without his katanas, they also showed off Liu Kang. They brought back his nunchucks so that you could equip those, thus changing his move setup, or you can have him unequipped and change his move sets, and they were just showing off a bunch of stuff in it. The game looks pretty, sounds pretty. I'm super stoked. Not sure, like I said at the beginning, if I'm going to be getting this or if I'm going to be getting Samurai Showdown. It all depends on what kind of everything looks like by the time everything comes out.
Have you seen, and if so, what's your favorite fatality?
Weirdly enough,
you haven't seen one.
Who does have my favorite fatality? Weirdly enough, so Liu Kang, not his fatality, they've actually, like, hinted at his fatal blow, which is the big-ass dragon being summoned and chopping the guy and, like, biting the guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's his fatal blow, not his fatality. And his fatal blow looks fucking awesome. His favorite fatality right now, I want to say, you know, I don't know. I've seen a few of them. I have not seen them all. There are YouTube videos all over the place with just all the fatalities. They're pretty.
Have they incorporated the X-ray system again into 11?
So they've got the... I forget what it's called. It's not an X-ray system, but that's kind of their fatal blow. You can do one fatal blow.
Okay.
When your health is below 25% by hitting L1 and R1, or right bumper, left bumper.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever the equivalent is for PC gamers, fight stick, whatever buttons you're hitting.
Yeah.
But each attack, if you do like a certain thing, you can then like boost that attack's damage by doing kind of an X-ray. So with dude with the hat, Kung Lao. That was the third character that they were demoing.
Oh, okay.
Kung Lao, with his dive kick is back. So if you land his dive kick three times, the next time you do his dive kick, it's a crushing blow, which is what it's called now. So then it just automatically does it.
Mm-hmm.
Liu Kang's bicycle kick, if you use his bicycle kick with the advanced feature three times, so making it just go forever, the next time you use the bicycle kick, it is a crushing blow.
Mm.
So things like that. There's like crazy things like Liu Kang gets an absorb, and if he literally absorbs a few different things and then does a thing, it becomes a crushing blow. Or he's got to do his air fireball directly into a bicycle kick is also a crushing blow.
Mm.
So some crushing blows are harder to get. Some crushing blows are like really easy to get, but you only get one crushing blow per round because
gotcha.
They do massive amounts of damage.
But you could technically execute a crushing blow several different ways, and if one style is not working out for you on your opponent, you can just switch to the other.
Yep. So yeah, so it's a beautiful looking game. I'm curious as to what they're going to do with the story, because the Mortal Kombat, like what's been going on with the story, is balls to the walls nuts.
We'll just have to wait for the next movie to come out.
So basically just watch all the cutscenes on YouTube, because this one's supposed to have the current characters where they are, meeting where the the character's past self. So like Liu Kang's evil. He is the ruler of the Outworlds.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to meet young Liu Kang, who is a hero through and through. Fucking Raiden's also evil. He's going to meet good Raiden. So just the amount of things that have changed is going to be a good time.
I always thought Raiden was evil just because people always beat my ass with him. And I thought no good person would do this.
It seems very convenient that they have Raiden basically pulling a Superman Injustice.
Yeah.
Like they have experience telling that story.
Yeah, hey, if it works.
But yeah, that's all I had to say about Mortal Kombat X, since I haven't had a chance to play it. I have been playing FIFA.
Oh my God, Cookie, I have such special news to share with you.
You got PlayStation Plus?
I do have PlayStation Plus. I'm online, baby. I haven't used it even once yet, but I bought it.
Sweet. Now we just need to, get on Red Dead. Start ourselves a posse.
I need to find myself some NHL. That would be... I'll play NHL all day.
Hey, man, if you want to chat.
Once I have it.
I think it... Is it still on sale?
I don't know. I'll check. If it's still on sale, I'll probably go for it. Not probably. I will go for it.
So then we can play Chell together.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's my gaming talk besides almost to end game on Division 2. I'll keep you guys posted as soon as I get there.
Sounds good. In other games with numbers following them, Suikoden 3, you had some things to say, Neil?
Yeah. I mean, I always feel bad to bring it up because I'll be talking it. I could always talk about it next week. So since we're at 43 minutes, let's actually just talk about Sekiro.
Okay. And we will go ahead and limit Sekiro to as far as... Cookie, have you played it all?
Yeah, I got powerbombed into the little past.
Bit. Yeah, that's right.
So
that's as far as I got, basically.
Big light spoiler warning, or lack thereof, of spoilers. We probably won't be getting into story, but we're going to be talking mechanics and overall gameplay.
Let's say very, very early game spoilers, because from now that I know where each of, where both of you are at, and I know where I'm at personally, there's still a lot of content you guys haven't touched yet that change the game that we can talk about once we all get there.
I won't be getting there. I don't own this game.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
I rented it. See, that's saving money, a little bit at a time.
No. That's a really good choice.
So I guess I will start, since I am the least far in my analysis of the gameplay of Suikoden.
Suikoden. Neil dies twice. Neil streams twice.
That is true.
Sekiro, basically, the way I was kind of playing it, I was, after getting through the main tutorial of being forced to fight, one-on-one and doing actual, fighting, quote-unquote.
Mm-hmm.
I say fighting because it's got a good fighting mechanic. But after doing that portion and getting into a little more of the open world, I turned this game into fucking Tenchu and loved every second of it. And for those who don't remember, Tenchu was that old school on the Xbox 360 days, hardcore ninja. You really can't fight all that well, but if you have to, you can kind of throw down. But everything's all about sneaking around, stealth killing as much as you possibly can, using your tools and gadgets to your advantage. So yeah, just turned the game into Tenchu. But you guys can go into your actual mechanics rundown, because you understand the mechanics a lot better than I do.
Probably. I think you're already tackling the biggest thing about Sekiro that is different from any other From Software game we've played, and that is that you actually can effectively use mobility across the map and stealth to take out your enemies without having to get into any sort of head-to-head combat for quite a while. There are a couple situations, I think, where ultimately, no matter how well you plan it out, there's probably one or two enemies you'll have to face head on. But these especially these early maps that all three of us have played, are super well made for sneaking and multiple pathways and like different tactics to taking down even the same enemy. Like I've found enemies that I could either get near a patch of tall grass and take out by throwing a ceramic shard at them, or jump on them from above, or hang on a ledge below them and pull them over with a like hanging ledge strike. And just the variety of options available makes the stealth element a lot more fun and a lot more interesting for this game than Dark Souls ever was. Because in Dark Souls, my approach to stealth was lure one guy, run like 500 feet backwards, get him to chase you so his friends don't see you, and then throw down one by one if you really had to.
So there is like an element of that that still kind of hangs around, depending on how balls to the wall good you are. I've made this comparison before, but this game kind of feels like Tenchu and Souls had a kid together, except they then let the kid go out into the wilderness and get raised by wolves.
Yeah, like, that's acceptable.
At its core, it is genetically a Souls game, as in like the systems and the way you navigate through the world and navigate through your menus and so forth.
Even the control scheme.
Yeah, it's quite literally a Souls game in every definition of the word, or like at least the system. It's kind of like playing Oblivion RPGs and realizing how they're all the same in terms of their core mechanic. But unlike the Bethesda games, the Souls games are well made and aren't just barfing out bugs and problems right at you. It's a fundamentally fun system, and this is just like a different take on that fun system with new mechanics and light
and a pause screen that works because there's no multiplayer in this game. There's no drop-ins by online opponents or cooperators. You can pause in this game and it actually stops the game time, which means that like mess of item management and menu navigation that I think half the reason I play Dark Souls on PC is because I have my controller with the four mappable paddles on the back end. You can just take out. Now you can just go into your inventory and activate an item and not need to have it in your quick items list.
This game being a Souls game, I wish it wasn't a Souls game, because I was doing so good, like barely had any health loss, had most of my things, and everything was going great. Just got done killing some doggos, got an item to customize myself, and I was like, you know what? I deserve this. I'm going to take a little bit of a rest. And I took a rest, and then looked down, and there those doggos were, staring back up at me. And this time they barked. You know what happens when they bark? People hear.
Yeah.
And then I was significantly worse off than I was before.
So part of the metaphor or simile that it's a Souls and Tenchu raised by wolves child sort of thing, I think is reflected a lot in its combat. While it is absolutely like its own polished thing, when you think about the combat relative to Bloodborne and Dark Souls, it's quite a bit faster. And in some ways, you could almost think, or you could see the combat as being heavily simplified, in that you are, at least for the early game, predominantly using one weapon. You are Wolf, as he's referred to. You're not changing between different class types. And really, you're relying on two buttons. Like, it's two-button combat with extra features as you go through the game. You hit, or you deflect, or you guard and be a weenie. But that's the same button as deflect.
There's also contextual inputs on the buttons.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Too.
So okay. I just want to, though, like, describe, though, that, like, Dark Souls and Bloodborne have contextualized inputs, too, for your hard and your weak and hard attacks. And you also have, like, way more systems in play, too. The different weapons, well... In Dark Souls, you have one-handed and two-handed operation with different movesets. Yeah. In Bloodborne, you have trick weapons. This game does kind of simplify it, but at the same time, by simplifying it, it allows them to go way more in-depth with a smaller dimension in combat. Because you're not switching, or because you don't have an archer character and a thief character and a mage character and then your samurai character, this game is super in-depth samurai, or rather I should say shinobi action. And as a result, like, while you find yourself relenting back to some of your Souls-like tendencies or Bloodborne tendencies, the game really wants you to play it like Sekiro, which is entirely different.
The Bloodborne, or what is it? The Soulsborne combat tendencies that you have are bad habits for Sekiro in some ways.
Well, sweet. I don't have those tendencies. Didn't have those tendencies.
Which I
played
think...
I played a little Souls too.
And I think you played a little Bloodborne, right?
A tiny Bloodborne. Like,
just a little droplet of Bloodborne.
Killed like four things in Bloodborne. Souls, I got to ring a couple of bells.
That's pretty good. But seeing as there's two bells, that's actually very good. It is 100%
there are only
completion
two bells?
Rate. Yeah. Yep.
Sweet. I thought there were three this entire time.
Nope. No, you
damn,
got them
I'm
both.
I'm so confused. But yeah, so I really like the traversal mechanic. In one portion, before getting powerbombed into the past, I was like, ooh, I wonder what's over here. Giant chicken. Okay, cool. Giant chicken's dead. What's... I find myself looking off of a lot of ledges now. Mm-hmm. Like, what's over this ledge? Oh, that looks like the things that I can grapple onto. It doesn't have a thing here, but...
You're
gonna I'm just going to jump at it and find out. Ooh, yes. Spam button, spam button, spam button. Yes. Sweet. There are a bunch of items over here. That's pretty cool. That ledge is way too far. Is it?
Gonna jump at it. Yeah.
Jump at it. Yep. That ledge is too far. I'm pretty sure I'll get something later on that lets me get to that ledge. But yeah, so it's got a nice traversal mechanic, which is something I did not like in the Souls games, because since you are playing a knight, they weren't going to be as tricky as a shinobi would be. So they would just walk from place to place and roll from place to place.
You technically have five planes of movement in Dark Souls when you're not using... Well, okay, let's say you have a ladder or a staircase or something. You have six planes of movement, which are like up and down using specific items in the environment or just dropping off of ledges. And therefore, your up and down are actually pretty limited. In Sekiro, it's like with that grappling hook, you can go anywhere as long as there's a couple grapple points near you, and your mobility is not just up, down, left, right, but it's like diagonal over onto this pagoda, or I can hit two grapple points at once to do sort of a like vertical movement on one and then a large lateral movement on another, and that movement feels so good and very unlike those Dark Souls and Bloodborne games. It's just the best that they could do in those games is like you could drop from a ledge into a secret area or uncover a ladder. But besides that, there's really no way to break the linearity of a lot of those maps. And I'd say that even this starting area, which is pretty linear, still has so much more variety in how you can approach it. Like right after you leave the dilapidated temple, did you guys take the... Like, there were three paths that I could think of. You could either sort of go the back side around this mountain through the Ashina village outskirts. You could go up to the top where the buildings were and a couple scouts, or you could go through the tall grass down on the bottom. Each one of them has their own items and their own guards and enemies that can really only see you when you're in those particular areas. And you can progress to the next... like sculpture or idol through either one of those routes without having to really access or contact the other route at all. Like you're already given three branching options that lead to the same spot, but that you only need to really follow through on one. But because of the grapple points, you can also move across all three on the way there. which is very different from just like trudging up a hill and across a bridge to get to the next bonfire in Dark Souls.
I don't recall which path I took, but I know immediately after I took the first one, I went back, doubled over, took the second, and then third. Like, so you can't really farm in this game the same way you could in other games, which also provides like an interesting element of legitimately the solution is to get good, when technically speaking in Bloodborne and Souls, if you hit a boss that was too hard, aside from other things that we can talk about, one option you could do is just farm up and raise whatever stat you find to be insufficient for that boss. This one, on the other hand, this game, you end up farming experience, but that is used for, which I don't think we've talked about, but quite literally the skill system. So instead of improving your stats in the traditional sense of killing enemies, you do so, I mean, indirectly, I guess you do so still, but it's not in the familiar fashion of killing mobs and weak enemies to improve your stats through the use of souls. Instead, now
you also don't lose it all on death, which is a big change as well. You end up losing half, but I don't know how bad you guys, if you guys hit any really bad ruts, but I hit some really bad ruts. And if you make it to, let's say, three skills, like you've collected three skill bars, you're depleting the bar to skill four. You're not losing skill three, two, or one. So once you earn that amount of skill points, it's not rescinded from you. Well, in Dark Souls, you can gather a million souls. And then if you die, it's gone if you don't get back to that bloodstain. So there is sort of a forgiving element in the fact that like these, you can reach a checkpoint with skill. With money, you're kind of SOL. Like you just continually lose money. But when you have six coins and you lose half, that's only three coins. So that's not so bad.
So there's also two things though that come into play here. The first is that even with the coins, you can technically go and buy more coin purses, which do not disappear upon your death. I don't know how many you can buy as you go through the game.
It's a 10% charge.
Yeah.
There's a limit for each vendor, but as far as I've gone in the game, you really don't, like, you will find a new vendor normally before you run out of buying those coin pouches, because you're still going to be buying other things. But it's a 10% charge to save coins as a like small, a regular, or a heavy coin pouch.
That's true.
And there may be more, but who knows?
So
I'm not there yet. I'm not at Bloodstone Chunk. I'm still at twin bone shards.
So you have that element to it. And the second one is, and maybe we talked about it already, but I don't think we have, the element of resurrection, the aspect of Shadows Die Twice.
We haven't talked about it.
Which
we have not.
When you're a giant coward like me, this specific mechanic is beautiful because, so the idea is that the penalties of death only come once you have either accepted death, died twice, or potentially more, I'm assuming, as the game goes further, or get killed in a way that there is no coming back from, i.e. power bombed off of ledges.
Off a ledge, yeah.
So I personally have found and embraced this mechanic of being able to save your experience and money, because as soon as I die once, my instant reaction is time to run the fuck away and go rest and rinse and repeat the process of preparing for the fight and, you know, seeing if I can conquer it that time.
Which I think is a much smarter use of the mechanic than I originally understood, because did either of you guys die enough that you found any consequences towards death?
After I got power bombed, everyone else got sick.
Yes, yeah. That ended up happening to me as well. Not the power bomb to death part. I mean, that might have been when everyone got sick, but
no, that's whenever, because I did the hey, I get to resurrect and die again thing, and then it's like, okay, you're just accepting death. That happened to me a few times, and then when I got power bombed the second time, then it was like, oh. Death is not your time yet. Can't talk. Talk to Shrine Maiden Priestess number two.
Number five?
This is such good cough audio.
subtitles of cough. But yeah, yeah, then you talk to old girl and she's like, you've got the dragon sickness. I don't know much about it, but pray using that bell that blind lady gave you. Also, go talk to that immortal dude.
So I'm super curious about the dragon rot blood droplets. I think that's what you have to use to heal people.
It's a dragon's blood droplet, it's a dragon's blood droplet, and
you get pipettes. Pipettes for the dragon blood?
There are no pipettes. This is unfortunately a very hazardous environment, and they would not be passing OSHA standards. But the way, so you haven't used that, Neil and Cookie. No. I assume you didn't restore the rot.
I did use it.
No, I got okay. I got thrown into the past, got confused, found myself fire. I invented fire. And then had to go to bed, and then it was the day I had to return the game. So after work that day, I went and returned the game.
Yeah.
So how do you get more droplets? Because it seems like I didn't have to do anything special for the first one. I just got it from the lady.
Yeah. They are an inexpensive but incredibly finite resource. So you find more blood droplets, or you're able to purchase more blood droplets, but they are very rare, and therefore the game sort of does have a counter for how many times you've died, in the sense that if you want to progress through the game without all of your side characters getting sick and therefore being prevented from doing whatever their usual function or task is, or completing their From Software like side quests where they're just in a new area after you talk to them or fulfill some esoteric requirement, you only have so many times that you can cure them from the dragon rot.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and resurrecting does not actually, what I thought initially, because I experienced what happens when you get dunked on a lot and everybody gets sick, is resurrection doesn't actually have any sort of penalty. It is death itself that has the penalty. So I abstained from resurrecting in a couple fights in particular, because I kept losing them and I'm like, oh, I don't want to keep wasting this resurrection option because I don't want to give people the illness. But then I realized that people will still pick up the illness if you choose not to resurrect. So there's no penalty to resurrecting multiple times. If you can do it, you should do it. And if anything, escape and use the Homeward Idol, an item that, unlike all of the other home teleport items that have existed in previous From Software games, does not actually come with a penalty of you losing experience or sen or anything. It is a free teleport back to a safe location.
So that is, it's interesting that you thought that was how the mechanic worked, because I think Tiffany also thought that, and so did John, John, and Cookie apparently. But I realized what it was as soon as it was told to me, or maybe I just happened to misread it in a way that made me know how it worked.
From Software games are so tricky to understand at times. There, for instance, was a point in time where I eavesdropped upon enemies who were talking about a location that stored an item that turns out to be a shinobi prosthetic tool. But during the eavesdropping conversation, they say something along the lines of, "We do not take from the Buddha. Bad things may happen." And so I left this item alone for, I think, maybe 5 to 10 hours, and then finally decided to go pick it up and realized that it was an item that would have helped me a lot in some of my encounters, because I thought I would receive some sort of consequence from stealing from the Buddha, because From Software are the type of developers where you can do something that seems innocuous and it will change the entire game for you. And so it's tricky. It's hard to interpret still. They've definitely kept the level of like unknown and mystery just as high as it is in any of the other games that they've made that I've played.
So,
but now I'm looting every Buddha.
And that's like one particular position where just before or just after you have the opportunity to loot that thing, you're confronted with the enemies that it would work extremely well
for.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you get the scissors to the paper enemies right in front of you. And if you didn't, I also found myself like reluctantly taking it when I found it. And when I was watching Tiffany play that same part, I watched her skip by it. And I was just like, you're going to want to take that. She's like, but they just said, don't steal from Buddha.
It's confusing. I don't know. I'm confused by it because they didn't take from Buddha, but it's totally cool for me to yank from Buddha. No problem. And
well, so
I ended up spending 10-ish hours dealing with shield enemies, not being able to break their shields, and the techniques to deal with that are very bad. You either goad them into attacking and you have to deflect them twice in a very short period of time to break their posture, or you have to sprint past them and do a spinning sword slice so you can hit their back, and it takes two attempts on that. And it made certain boss fights or mini boss fights in which where those shielded enemies were part of the cannon fodder much, much harder to deal with than just smashing them with the prosthetic axe tool and taking them down right after that.
So we talked about this ever so slightly before we started recording, but would you say this game is the hardest Souls experience for you so far?
I think what I had said in that initial part of our discussion, or at least one of the context pieces that I need to apply, is it took me ages to pick up the mechanics of Bloodborne and just not be really bad at that game. I was scared of parrying effectively with the guns, and I didn't understand exactly how to best utilize the trick weapons to continue attacking opponents and staggering them and keep my momentum up, because that, I think that's a game that requires a very aggressive forward momentum in the way that the Souls games, where the sword and board technique really works well in most scenarios. Bloodborne's all about this like high octane press the attack, and Sekiro in a sense is now utilizing that same approach of always engaging your opponent and not backing up or backing away unless you absolutely have to, but also being patient enough to deflect strikes to break posture. And so I'd say, because almost I'm conditioned to play by these other two types of combat from the Souls games and Bloodborne, that Sekiro probably is the hardest of the games that I've played. It's also the most rewarding. It has frustrated me more than almost any Dark Souls game has ever, and it's definitely frustrated me more than Bloodborne. And I've done much worse against what are mini bosses, not even like full-fledged area bosses that I need to defeat to get past like a certain fog gate. But it feels so good. I mean, it gets the blood pounding. There's a couple mini bosses I've beat that I've like felt my heart rate just like elevate insanely afterwards, because I landed a chain of like 12 parry or 12 deflects in a row to get a posture strike. It is a really hard game. And you can make it harder too. There is actually a mechanic in the game that ups the difficulty of the fights that we'll talk about in a later episode when you guys get there. But I'm actually playing with the difficulty increasing mechanic active currently, and it makes the game more fun. It's even harder and it's even more punishing, but it's also more rewarding because of it.
Ugh, I can't imagine.
I'm so excited that we talked about before, I think it was before Sekiro came out, but after we were aware of Sekiro, about how do we feel about the fact that this isn't going to be another Bloodborne game, even though the teaser trailer like could have been just like it could have been linked to Bloodborne and the fact that it was gory and it had bones and weird mechanisms that made us suspect that maybe this is a sequel to Bloodborne. And I talked about how maybe not having a sequel is actually the best thing for that game. I'm very sold on that opinion now because I feel like Sekiro is so refreshing and exciting and an even harder experience than Bloodborne. And you have to, in order to have Sekiro, you can't have Dark Souls 4 or Bloodborne 2 at this point in time.
This feels like if Bloodborne was always meant to be a one-off, though that is potentially not true based upon Deracine, I would love if From Software just stopped making sequels and kept doing one-offs like this that
because
were all like,
yeah, they're amazing so far.
So I guess I have like one last note. When you're in the Hirata state in the quote-unquote dream past, whatever you want to call it, the music in that is so hauntingly similar to Deracine, which is their PlayStation VR game where you play as essentially a ghost or a spirit.
Hmm.
It's like the first time in any of these Souls games or any of From Software's games, minus
Armored Core.
Yeah, which, I mean, this might be true of that too. It's any of the times where I actually felt like the music was on par with the rest of the game. And maybe it's just that the other soundtracks haven't really ever gotten me. And ignoring Deracine, because I thought like the soundtrack in Deracine is particularly one of higher quality than other elements of the gameplay, but not necessarily saying that the music was amazing in Deracine. But fuck, man. I really hope that as I'm going through the game more and more, that there are going to be more tracks that just have that establish such a mood to him that was like almost hauntingly menacing yet beautifully sad at the same time.
I think there's going to be some opportunities for that for sure.
Holy shit. I did not know that Tenchu actually was a Farm Software game.
I didn't know that either, actually.
So
yeah, Tenchu Z, the one that I was alluding to, my favorite Tenchu was From Software, and so was Tenchu Shadow Assassins.
And I don't know if we've ever technically confirmed it while we were talking in the past or anything, but this game was literally, as confirmed by From Software staff, this game was originally Tenchu.
Yeah.
And it became Sekiro. So
like
the very fabric and reason that we see these similarities is completely justified by the basis of that, of the original pursuit or game they had in mind. So I take it for now we can put Sekiro to rest
for now.
So I only had one last quick thing to bring up, and that's that I spent some significant time playing Persona 3 Dancing in Moonlight, which I have mixed opinions about. I won't go too far into it or spend too much time talking about it, but I did want to say, first and foremost, the story of Persona 4 Dancing All Night was at times campy and nonsensical, you could even say, but it at least felt substantial. And Persona 3 Dancing in Moonlight really feels like, if there is, I'm really holding my breath and holding on to the hope that there's actually a story. But it opens up by literally saying, slight spoilers, I don't know if it is even worth saying that there might be spoilers in this, because there might very well not be spoilers. It might literally be no story, because you're introduced to the game as it being a dream that all of the characters are experiencing together, and that as soon as the dream is over, that their memories will disappear of this dream. So it's legitimately, hey, we need to figure out a way to have like all of these characters in their original age from the first, or from Persona 3, and be able to dance. And we're calling it a dream sequence, aka Persona Q and Persona Q2 potentially all over the place. Putting aside the egregious loss of opportunity at making a ridiculously fun, stupid story like they did for 4, the game looks amazing. Like, I look at the graphics and I look at the character models and the rendered back or rendered the backgrounds that they use for each of the dance stages, and what I see in front of me is quite literally all of the assets you need to just remake Persona 3. And while Persona 3 is like not by far not my favorite Persona, and it's actually relatively low on my list, or at least of the three, it's the lowest. But holy shit, seeing those assets in such great detail on a PlayStation 4, mind you, it gets me so excited about the potential remake of this game. And since Atlas is very, very notorious, and not necessarily, it's not a bad thing, but they're famous for reusing assets, I see this dancing game and I pray with every fiber of my body that they're also working on a remake with these same assets.
For Persona 3.
For 3, yeah.
That so, already had a remake, right? With Fess?
Fess was literally... It's like the equivalent of DLC.
Okay. It was Persona 4 Golden or Persona 5 The Royal.
Yep, which are essentially DLC, but we always are going... Japanese company that doesn't really do DLC and never has to begin with. And yeah. You can't blame them. It's a bad practice, but they already have fans that are willing to buy a new game for this added content. So you may as well. But in the case of Persona 3 Portable, where they did have a female protagonist, I kind of feel like that was worth it for that price. I'm only saying that caveat because I am not so sure that Persona 5 The Royal is actually going to have a confirmed female protagonist anymore.
I'm still banking on it.
I hope you're right. I'm just like starting to become reluctant about that assumption.
Persona 5 Ryuji.
So, will you play Persona 5 Dancing in Starlight?
Fuck yeah. I just didn't play it because Tiffany hasn't finished Persona 5 yet. So, we weren't going to start with that.
Until it's been...
Until she's finished it.
So once you do that, you have to tell me which is the best dancing game.
Well, I mean, sorry, let me correct myself. I know I just said that, but rather, I am probably going to play Persona 5 Dancing in Starlight on my own at some point. I might do it for stream. Who knows? I really hope there's a story, a ridiculous story to it, because there's definitely some opportunities in Persona 5 that... I find myself, like, laughing at this statement. But there's an opportunity that you can make... in Persona 5 storyline to create a situation for dance. Ridiculous, yes, but I think you very well could have, like, I mean, we did a spoiler cast on it. We can talk about it extremely quickly because I don't want us to, you know, spend too much time on the topic. But, you know, they literally are leaving Tokyo in a fucking van at the end of Persona 5, right? They're basically going on spring break. I mean, they're technically taking the protagonist back to their hometown, but like they could literally stop and have a dance party. Like, it's not that far fetched.
Sweet, I like it.
Comments, questions, or corrections, you can write into podcast@fancyramen.com.
Don't be afraid to leave us reviews and. Sign it with super funny names and super funny reviews, and we'll read that. We'll read that. We promise. Unlike last time, Neil didn't tell anybody. / it didn't actually update on any of our things. I'm sorry.
I don't know where they are now. I'm having troubles finding them. I maybe have to go in on my Mac instead of on PC. I don't know.
Probably. I have no doubt that it's easier to find the same exact data using an Apple product. Through iTunes versus trying to use a PC to access iTunes. Please tell your friends about your favorite podcast genre, Fancy Ramen. The best way for us to get new listeners is from word of mouth, and the biggest help you can do is spread the word.
That does it for episode 113 of Fancy Ramen Podcast.
I'm Cookie.
I don't.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Neil, and I don't have a title for this one that doesn't use the same joke we used last week.
Sekiro, jokes die twice.
That's
well,
it.
Well, you could do Sekiro. No, what's the game that you were playing earlier? It doesn't matter.
Suikoden.
Oh yeah, you could do Suikoden, same title twice, a second time, the redo.
Oh man,
just full stop.
Sekiro jokes die twice, unless you get thrown. Power bombed.
Unless you get power bombed
off a ledge.